Good evening, Raymond. Well, what about that?
What about that indeed, Tomás? I found myself there with the Copland and the Gershwin responding completely differently to the two pieces. I found that I was much more engaged by the Gershwin. The Copland left me just wondering slightly, the Billy the Kid suite. I wonder, Tomás, is it because, for instance, it was written as a ballet piece and all we have here this evening is the music? Are we feeling, is there something slightly missing? Is there one leg of the piece missing there? I just found that it was very pleasant, a pleasant succession of sounds and so forth, but I didn't find myself being really grabbed by it. Now, I should say, of course, that it's many years since I first heard the opening glissando.
That is a fine glissando altogether.
To Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, but that, I mean, that, as I said, maybe 30 years ago, that crept underneath my skin and right. It's still there. It was one of those sounds, you know, that haunting, slightly squeaking almost, but lilting sound, you know, warbling about, and it just... And if you see some performances, Tomás, you see where the clarinet player goes way up, lifts the clarinet way up into the air to play it out loud and back down again. It's a real, you know, jazzy, wonderful opening.
Whenever I see it performed, even in, you know, in the orchestral setting, it's the bit, it's the elephantine lifting of the nose of jazz to the classical world, you know. And you often have the, you know, you have the player stand up even sometimes as they do that, and it's, you know, here we go. It's not quite two fingers to the classical modes that were there in the 20s, and here's the jazz age beginning. But it certainly is like that. And if there was ever a, now that's what I call a classical music opening, this would be probably track one or two on it, I would have thought.
Well, yes. The only one I can think of that might upstage is from Beethoven.
Right, well, which, I think the fifth could go first.
Yeah, you know, it probably would, but it is immediately recognisable. And it's a great juxtaposition of jazz and classical forms. It works very, for me, it works very well. It grabs me from the beginning. It holds my attention right the way through. It's dramatic. It's haunting. It's got all sorts of combinations there. And, of course, people often said about Gershwin, he was this fantastic songwriter. I mean, he just turned out fantastic songs. But over Christmas there, I got a book called Daily Rituals. I don't know if you heard of it. And it's all about artists, writers, composers, and how they worked, what their ritual was. Up at six, go for a walk, coffee, whatever it might be.
Oh, like my own.
I thought you were up at 5:30 tonight.
Oh, yeah, 5:30, sorry, yes.
But Gershwin, according to his brother Ira, Gershwin was a 12-hour-a-day workaholic. He'd be at the piano, sitting in his pyjamas. He mightn't have even got dressed, working away all the time.
Are you sure this isn't about me?
Well, Thomas, but you're 14 hours, I thought. But he often said, and I love this quote, because people often talk about inspiration. He said, if I relied on inspiration, I would write 3 songs a year. He said, there's no room for inspiration here. You've got to get on and do it. And as he said, just like the pugilist, I must stay in training. I must work at it every day. And it shows in his work. It shows, you know, that he did that sort of thing. And I have to say, over the first half of the concert, my vote is certainly going for Gershwin over Copland. I don't know where you stand on that.
You're just really, what you're reacting to, or what a lot of people react to, therefore, is this idea of embracing America as the exciting city-orientated world. And that other world, the Billy the Kid world, was almost dead by the time Copland was even writing about it. And that's this great longers, you know, these big wind, and, you know, there's great wind instruments fluting away over a wild rolling landscape. So again, it's kind of the difference between a Scorsese film, which is the sort of the Gershwin, and then Tarkovsky, if you want, or maybe Wim Wenders' Paris, Texas, is Billy the Kid. It's this long shot, and we're seeing that. But I like both, and that's the brilliance of, you know, of American music. It's the brilliance. They have both of these being exposed beautifully. And I suppose what's interesting there is that the immediate things that jump to my mind are both non-American film directors, because the only person who's really managed for me to actually evoke this are non-Americans, unless you're looking at classical music, and then you've got Copland. Yep. And that's the interesting thing. You know, you've got John Ford, John Huston, you've got the Western, people making Westerns, who have a little bit of this, but it tends to be cut up with, you know, a sort of a cowboy and Indian fight every so often. They don't want the long, lingering look. The only one I can think of, really, and I was kind of pitching it in my mind as I was listening to the Billy the Kid suite, and that was really John Wayne framed in the door in The Searchers, you know, yes. where we've got the long walkaway shot, and we've he's willing to give it that. But, you know, so Copeland should have directed films, that's what I'm saying.
Well, it's interesting to us, you mentioned there about the long walkaway shot, and you also talked about those the sort of the lonesome prairie type of thing there. I loved, I shouldn't be too down on the Copeland piece, I really loved the opening of it. Because as I sort of thought, it whispers into life, you know? It sort of creeps up on you gradually, opens up, and only gradually then begins to build. And immediately, I had this vision of, you know, the lonely campfire, the lonesome prairie, all that sort of thing. So, yeah, that it captured me in that sense. I just wonder, I would come back and say, I wonder, is it missing the ballet element of it, you know? Is it left a little bit... slightly lopsided or something like that.
So you're taking up my criticism earlier on in the season when I said that we get a lot of sweets here, which are really the tasters, the openers for a good ballet evening. And, you know, that's really what I'd like now if we sat down and watched the thing. So I think what we're actually demanding is a national ballet, a large centre for ballet in Ireland. Of course, you could also be picking up on Diaghilev when he said, I think of Ravel's La Valse, where he says this isn't a ballet, it's a photograph, or it's a picture of a ballet. And he said it was undanceable. And I think, you know, again, when you listen to suites all the time, what you're getting is you're getting a picture of a ballet.
That's true, Tomás, but perhaps looking forward to the second half here with the Tchaikovsky Sleeping Beauty suite... I don't think it'll show the same, well, from my point of view, perceived lack. And I think it's because in that case here, you've got that much more, you know, romantic, lyrical type of typical what you'd call Tchaikovsky music. His music is some of the most recognised. You know, it is Tchaikovskyan, if you can say such a thing. And I don't think, you know, I've heard this before, obviously, plenty of times. It doesn't seem to lose out by just being played as an orchestral piece of music and not performed as a ballet as well. And I think it comes from the fact that those great sweeping melodies and they're so familiar, as I've said to you before as well, about them almost from our youth. They're sort of ingrained in our DNA, those melodies and so forth.
It's also it's compositional as well, and it's part of the, you know, the advancing structure of music, particularly classical music, in that a lot of what you're looking at in the 20th century is people and composers particularly trying to be evocative and trying to use the, you know, to use the classical form as poetic and very imagistic, rather than, you know, falling back on previous ideas of structured tunes and rhythms, melodies, counter melodies. You know, the complexity of classical composing, it gives way to this idea of passion and emotion and pictures. There's another bit as well that struck me, and when I'm thinking about it, I want to think again about it. Obviously, we know the piece, and it's never done it for me. Why? Where is the vision of rural Russia? You know, this lonesome giganticness that should be Russia. It's the biggest country on earth, and yet we have Copeland here with Billy the Kid and many others, Appalachians, all the rest of them, where you've got this lyrical, you know, evocation of that big space, the big country. Why do we call it? Where's Russia's big country composer?
You've sort of got me there, Thomas. But I wonder, is it because if you think of the way even St. Petersburg was built, it was the window on the west.
Yes.
They were looking west, and I think it was Western classical music. It wasn't looking east. It wasn't looking out across, you know, whenever they built the Trans-Siberian Railway, that sort of thing. It was the window on the west was St. Petersburg, and the influence was coming in there. You know, but I think perhaps Billy the Kid, even when it was written, was talking about something which was almost lost, whereas Gershwin, even though he didn't specifically say it was about New York, I mean, it evokes the big city, whether it's New York or LA or whatever. It evokes the big city, which is still contemporary, going on all the time. We still know that city, the towering skyscrapers and so forth. The Billy the Kid thing is now, it's now in your history class. And maybe that's why it seems to speak to me more and evoke a clearer image and really grab me. And that's what I love about Rhapsody in Blue. I could listen to Rhapsody in Blue again and again and again without ever tiring of it.
Possibly because we're all so familiar with it. It's one where people have real favourites of how it's performed. But it's also one of those classical pieces, and I think that's what I love about it, is it was certainly for me, it was a piece that allowed me to see that the way in which orchestration occurs really affects a classical music legacy. Because if we were left with, you know, a piano roll performance and a small jazz Dixieland, band at the back of it, it could be a very different thing to the, you know, the large and complex orchestration that it becomes. You see that again in something like Ravel's piece here this evening, Mother Goose, where it could have been left as just a two-hander, a double-hander, a four-hand piece for children and also for, you know, for someone learning the piano, basically what it was written for by Ravel. Or when it becomes orchestrated later on, now you get this hugely symphonic and very lonely. There's another theme this night, tonight, loneliness. This, you know, Mother Goose in the orchestrated form is a very lonely piece. Like Billy the Kid is kind of lonely, and there's a hint of loneliness in Sleeping Beauty too.
Yeah. Well, certainly in the Ravel piece, I find I like that. I think in the programme notes this evening they said something about feathery fun or something like that. There are a whole lot, and there's some gorgeous little violin solos as well, but there's lots of sort of very hushed, whispering solo sounds from different instruments in the orchestra, which I really find quite attractive. It's there is that loneliness there. It's touching on something which is left largely unsaid. I think it's left for the listener to fill in those gaps. And from that point of view, certainly the orchestral version for me is far superior to anything you can do on simply one or two pianos. There's quite a strong link to us between Gershwin and Ravel. I gather it was something to the effect where Gershwin wanted to study with Ravel, and Ravel said to him, you know, you're a first-rate Gershwin, and I don't want to turn you into a second-rate Ravel. When I tell you a little aside, Tomás, about Ravel, myself and Fionnuala were off on a holidays there. We were driving down through France, and I booked in to stay a night in advance without any prior knowledge or anything in this village, Montfort-l'Amaury, which is close to Paris. So we stopped the night there, and the next morning went for a walk around and discovered that Ravel had spent the last 16 years of his life there. There's a Ravel Museum, his house has been converted, all sorts of things. But that's not really what I wanted to tell you.
Okay.
We went out that night for a steak frite. Steak frite can be fairly shoddy. You know, they give you some El Scrag end of steak. But when it's good, it's fantastic. But what I really want to tell you about, Tomás, was this béarnaise sauce. It was like a clotted custard almost. You know, it was thick, heavy, big, thick, buttery stuff. Not that watery old stuff. I had to call for a second pot of it. I think to us that we drank a Givry with it. I went for something not too strong and hefty. I wanted something with a nice crisp bit of acid to cut through all that cholesterol. But perhaps you...
Oh, I mean, I think you couldn't think of anything. Low in cholesterol is very important to me. But you're totally wrong. You'd have to go for a big beefy Cabernet. a nice bit of Napa, a nice Montalina Cabernet Sauvignon with a nice bit of steak. That's what I'd be looking for.
That's fairly whopping now, Tomás.
Yeah, that would be. That's what it needs.
I was driving the next day. They might have brought out the guillotine to sort you out then if you're ordering a big Napa Cabernet in the heart of France.
Not at all, because if they were fans of Ravel, they would know that he was a fan of America. He came over there, he got wild by Gershwin, changed the rest of his life. and I can do that too. I can bring them in a nice Napa and show them how they should be doing it.
Exactly. Tell me about Tchaikovsky, Tomás.
I suppose he's the odd man out here this evening because, you know, Ravel was hugely influenced by America, met Gershwin, did a tour, was, you know, really excited, and many jazzy pieces came forth. And in fact, one of the orchestration of Mother Goose has a little jazz in it. I just can't see much jazz in Tchaikovsky, but what he is he's a Western-facing Russian composer, and he was the most Western-facing of them. He also, of course, did a tour of of America, and he also went out into the into that milieu, the exciting open frontier. So there is a connection there, but not much.
Ladies and gentlemen, our doors will close in 5 minutes. We request that you take your seats in the auditorium. Our doors will close in 5 minutes.
Would Tchaikovsky be happy to be programmed here with these other three here tonight? They seem to link, as you said, they seem to have some commonality between them. He sits slightly apart, sits before them, obviously, sits slightly apart. In terms of reputation and recognition, obviously, he's the daddy of all of them, really. But I wonder, like, what would his opinion be if he knew this concert was on tonight?
To me, it doesn't fit that he would enjoy himself being placed in this context. I really don't think he would. I think we are happy to see the music in this context. We can see it. But what's really going on here is more it's more the overarching meta-narrative of his, you know, of the fairy tale and the suite and the ballet. That's the form that has them connecting us here tonight, rather than the underlying sort of history and philosophy of the actual composers themselves. Because there's a very good case, you know, for Ravel, Copland, and Gershwin all in this trio trio in this movement. Well, there is one connection, I suppose. One connection. You've got unusual deaths for Gershwin, Tchaikovsky, and Ravel. Copland lived to a grand old age, but you've got problematical things that were going on. So you've got
Gershwin,
he of course has the famous brain tumor, but car crashing and all the rest of it. Then you've got Ravel with a car crashing entree to his death. Obviously, it picks disease and he dies for other reasons. But you've got kind of very modern kind of deaths there for the two of them.
Deaths.
Yes, their downfall involves motor cars in some way, shape, or form. Whereas Tchaikovsky does have another this death. The controversy over was it, you know, was he pushed or did he fall? He dies of cholera. We know that much, and we know that he's dying just, you know, 6-7 days after the performance of Pathétique.
Yes,
nobody applauded for about three. There was 3 minutes of silence at the end of it. They didn't know, as if you know the piece, it ends very quietly, and if you were drifting off into a slight snooze at the end of a long, warm concert, you might be waiting for a ta-da before you get into your round of applause.
And if you were a fragile composer, that 3 minutes would feel like about 3 years.
About 9.5 years. I keep thinking of I Do Not Like Thee, Dr. Fell, and where, you know, they've got the main character is on the is going away, and he said his goodbyes, and an evil man who is in control of whether the train leaves or not keeps the train there on and on and on. So that you can't say that the goodbyes just fade into nothingness and meaningless in this evil way. And you have that with Pathétique. And the people didn't applaud. And 6 days later, he's dead.
And similarly, Tomás, you have with with The Sleeping Beauty. It was a slow starter in terms of public acclaim. I mean, now it's considered to be one of the, you know, benchmark pillars of the standard ballet repertoire. But it was a slow start. It was premiered in the Marinsky in St. Peter. If you ever go to St. Petersburg, Tomás, visit the Marinsky. When I first went there 10 years ago, there was the original Marinsky Theatre, which is still there, still current, still functional, so on and so forth. Since then, they've built a concert hall, magnificent new concert hall, and just last year they opened the Marinsky 2, another theatre. So in terms of a cultural hub, I hate that term, in terms of a cultural hub, I mean, it really is absolutely world-beating. But after that premiere, you know, it sort of trickled on, and it was only when performed in London after the first one in 1921, I think, that it, you know, people began to say, hey, yeah, this is a serious piece. And since then, of course, it's just become, as I said, part of the standard repertoire. Tomás, you've a particular interest in his relationship, Tchaikovsky's relationship with this slightly shadowy figure of Van Meck. What was her name again?
Yes, Van Meck. I think everyone who's interested in Tchaikovsky has an interest in that relationship without any difficulty. You know, how do you keep up a relationship like this with somebody who's giving you a lot of money, but then not wanting to meet you, but then on the other hand, sending you letters all the time in a way that makes you feel you're not quite worthy of their money, you haven't produced enough material for the money that they've given to you. Money's another connecting theme here tonight, because Ravel was always on the lookout for cash, was often giving things, and, you know, even like the Diaghilev with Le Vals, he had triumph and did make some money, but I think he again famously said to Gershwin came looking for lessons from him, which is always interesting about Gershwin was somebody who really wanted to learn. And even at the height of his success, he's going off to Ravel saying, you should teach me composition. And Ravel said, no, you should teach me about how to make money out of composing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And you know what happened to Ravel, of course? He made all his money after he was dead.
Yeah.
Of all French composers, he's earned more, or he, his estate has earned more from royalties than anybody else. And a lot of it from Bolero.
You see,
of course,
there I was seeing how good we were, both not mentioning Bolero, you know, and there you go and ruin it.
And you know what? I think it's actually Bolero, Tomás.
Well, now that sounds like a load.
Steady, tomorrow.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the final call. All doors are now closing, and we request that you take your seats in the auditorium immediately. Final.